Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
I'm Joe Moore. Thanks for joining us today. On our program, what's our expectation of privacy in this era of big data? We'll hear from communications expert Diane Blair. We'll also talk politics with Bill McEwen of the Fresno Bee and hear from local jazz vocalist Karen Margoth, who will join us in studio with her band. So stay tuned. You won't want to miss it. But first, we turn our attention to the ongoing saga of healthcare and overcrowding in California's prisons. All inmates at risk of developing a serious form of valley fever must be removed from two Central California state prisons. That's what a U.S. District Court judge ruled late Monday afternoon, upholding a directive from the federal official in charge of prison health care. The ruling comes over the objections of the State Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, which balked at the complexity of the policy. Valley Public Radio's Rebecca Plevin takes us behind the prison gates to explain how the state and inmates are coping with the problem.
The southern San Joaquin Valley is ground zero for valley fever, a potentially fatal disease that's practically unheard of in the rest of the state. It's also home to 10 state and federal prisons, and it's where Arjeng Panna became sick.
I had big welts all over my body. I was sweating profusely. Lost complete appetite. I was in extreme pain, as in my joints. I could not walk.
In 2006, Panna was serving time at the Taft Correctional Institution for possession of meth with the intent to sell. When he first became sick, doctors diagnosed him with pneumonia and prescribed antibiotics. The drugs didn't work, and his symptoms got worse.
One of the other kind of embarrassing symptoms that was I also suffered was a disease called hydrocele, which is the enlargement of your testicles. One of my testicles was the size of a grapefruit.
Those drugs didn't work because Panna didn't have pneumonia. Doctors finally diagnosed him with valley fever. It's a fungal disease caused by inhaling spores that live in the soil in this dry, arid region. Once the spores lodge in your lungs, they never fully leave your body.
I realized I did it wrong and I should do my time for it. I didn't believe that I should pay for my crimes with my life, which is pretty much what I was sentenced to.
Panna was a federal inmate in Kern County, which has the highest rate of valley fever in California. The disease is also a huge problem in the region's state prisons. In April, the federal official overseeing health care in the state prisons recommended that all inmates at high risk of contracting the serious form of the disease be removed from two Central Valley prisons. The policy affected thousands of inmates at Pleasant Valley and Avenal state prisons, including all African Americans and Filipinos. The state attorney general raised questions about the plan, but on Monday, a federal judge upheld a modified version of the order. In his ruling, Judge Thelton Henderson said that without the policy, at-risk inmates would, quote, continue to suffer unnecessary and unreasonable harm. Jeffrey Callison with the Department of Corrections says the state is still reviewing the ruling. The judge rejected the state's claims that it has adequately responded to the valley fever threat. Of all the state's prisons, Pleasant Valley and Coalinga has the highest rate of valley fever. Between 2006 and 2010, the rate of valley fever there was 1,001 times higher than the rate statewide.
We're going to take a little tour.
You want to be able to see the yard or?
On a June morning, Lieutenant Kirk Gerringer travels around Pleasant Valley in a golf cart. He points out the recreation yard where inmates kick soccer balls and throw frisbees. Just a tall fence and a layer of soil cement separate them from the dusty ground where the fungus thrives.
What the soil cement does is prevents the upkick of dust because the valley fever spore is in the dust. And when it gets kicked up and it's carried through the air, that's how generally you're made susceptible to it.
To further protect inmates, he says prison officials offer surgical masks and raise awareness about the disease through posters and television commercials. They have also tried planting grass on the prison grounds.
The grass is supposed to keep all the dirt down and there'd be less dust. However, unfortunately, the winter when we planted it was pretty dry and the seed didn't take.
So why is the valley fever rate so high in these prisons? Dr. Felix Igbinosa is the chief medical executive at Pleasant Valley.
The majority have abused alcohol, drugs, and they have, majority of them also have issues related to trauma, and they do not have access to healthcare while they were in the community.
They are also more likely to have chronic health problems like diabetes and lung disease, which puts them at higher risk for valley fever too. Inmates also spend lots of time in the dusty prison yard. And because many come from outside the region, they haven't built up immunity against the fungus.
Once they relocate to a valley fever endemic area and they are exposed to valley fever, they are not prepared by way of natural immunity to fight the disease.
Finally, he says, prison doctors might be more aware of the disease and therefore more likely to diagnose it. But no matter the reason, taxpayers are already paying a price for valley fever. The state prisons spend an estimated $23.4 million a year on valley fever among inmates. Last year, the federal government agreed to pay Arjang Panna a settlement of $425,000 while admitting no fault. Panna says he's grateful for the money, which will provide relief if he gets sick again. Still, he says, he'd do anything to not have the disease.
One of my dear friends came up to me and said, RJ, how much money would you pay for you not to have this disease? And I said, if you added an extra zero to the end of the settlement, I would pay that much money not to be sick from it.
The receiver's policy is intended to prevent thousands of other inmates from facing the same fate. According to the judge's ruling, all inmates affected by the receiver's policy must be transferred out of the two prisons within 3 months. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Plevin.
And Rebecca Plevin joins us now in studio. Rebecca, do we have any idea about the numbers of inmates affected by this order that came out last night, the ruling from the judge late Monday? We initially had an idea that it might be about 50%, but that was before the ruling.
That's right, Joe. So originally we expected that about 50% of the inmate population at Pleasant Valley and Avenal would be impacted by this order. That was about 3,200 inmates. Now it will probably be a little bit less because they've modified the policy. So now people who were previously diagnosed with valley fever will not be included, meaning so that people who have previously had valley fever will stay in the prisons, and the state is still determining with the CDC, I believe, whether people over age 55 need to be moved out of those two prisons also.
Now, this came out late last night, so the Department of Corrections is still reviewing it. What was their response before the decision yesterday? What was their reaction to the receiver's recommendation?
Right. So up until the decision last night, the state had maintained that moving 3,200 inmates out of these two prisons would be not impossible, but very complicated. And that was complicated by the fact that there's already an effort to reduce the prison population. So there's not a lot of extra beds across the state where they can just move inmates. And where inmates are housed is also complicated by their security level, by their mental health needs, and several other considerations. So they've maintained that it wouldn't be impossible, but it would be very challenging.
You have gang problems, and also do those factor into where prisoners are sent.
Absolutely.
Interesting. Well, I'm sure this is not the last we'll hear of this story, as the issue of prison overcrowding and prison health care is ongoing. And turning now to our guest, Bill McEwen from the Fresno Bee. Bill, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Joe.
Just last week, another federal court, in this case a three-judge panel, issued an order in this ongoing case about prison overcrowding and reducing the prison population, ordering the state to essentially release around 10,000 inmates by the end of the year. The governor and the state are saying that this is an unprecedented order and they're seeking an immediate stay of this. What is your analysis of what this means for the governor's realignment plan? He's taking hits on both sides from both Republicans and Democrats on this, and it seems like it has a very cloudy future right now.
Well, when you look at California's reaction to this entire problem over the last 10 or 15 years, it doesn't matter who the governor is. There's always protest. The governor always says we're doing the best we can. The governor always says, look at our prisons. We have a model prison system, and why are you picking on us? And then inevitably, the state of California does what it's ordered to do. So I think that's what's going to happen here as well.
That's not going to necessarily play very well with the public, though, because a lot of people are, I really don't care about prisoner health care. What do they need health care for? That's a sentiment that you hear a lot on the street. And there is certainly a good segment of the population that is troubled by the potential hearing that 10,000 inmates may be released early.
Well, but in the United States, we have this form of government, and you have the executive branch, and you have the legislative branch, and you have the judicial branch. And these decisions are primarily being driven by judges' rulings. And judges do not pay attention to popular sentiment. Their job is to read the law, know the law, and then apply the law and make those decisions. And one thing you have to remember is when you put someone in prison, you are saying we have responsibility for that person's health care. And so sentiment may be that, let the prisoners die if we're talking about Valley Fever, or why do prisoners have to receive such excellent medical care? And the courts have said, when you sentence somebody and you put them in prison, you are responsible for them. And I understand that's unpopular with a lot of people, but I don't see the judicial branch ever changing on that. It doesn't matter if the judge is liberal or conservative.
Speaking of state politics, we witnessed a very interesting turn of events over the past 2 weeks or so over this debate about the California Public Records Act and its inclusion in one of the budget trailer bills, basically a provision that would have allowed local governments to opt out of complying with portions of the law, saying that, well, the state's no longer going to provide the money that would reimburse local governments for complying with this. Have you seen legislators backtrack quite as fast as they did last week in recent memory?
Well, people are saying don't mess with people who buy ink by the barrel. but in this case, Joe, and I think you're aware of this, California state government gets very low marks for transparency, any kind of sunshine rating. And people in the media over about the last 5 years have made a concerted effort. And I think it's coupled with the economic downturn and the new challenges for the media. But the media wants to remind people that buy newspapers, listen to the radio, watch the television news, that if we're not finding out what's going on in government, how are you really going to find out? So there's been a big push to have more transparency in government. And then you have this thing hidden in the trailer bill. And there hasn't been a big discussion about this, but the secondary thing is, well, what about these crazy trailer bills? And what about this midnight legislation? Every year in California, you get this rush to the budget. And in the rush to the budget, special interests almost always are very well taken care of. So the media and the public have won the battle on the California Public Records Act as far as this bill, which would have allowed local government to opt out. I think the next thing you're going to see next year early on is a big push about doing something about midnight legislation. And, the Republican Party is a distinct minority here in California. The Democrats have the supermajority, and at least until Sunday when one person resigns to join a city council. I think this is something good for the Republican Party to stand on, to say that we're the party of transparency, and try and win back some of those swing voters, or as they're called, decline to state voters. So that's a big deal. But this was a very rapid turnaround, and part of it was, you were seeing the Democratic Party pilloried. You were seeing Governor Brown taken on. And I think it's very hard also for Senate Pro Tem Steinberg, Assembly Speaker Perez, and Governor Brown to actually defend this bill in any shape or form. One other thing about this, Joe, and you have filed Freedom of Information Act requests, you have filed the California Public Record Act request, and local government often says, oh, we don't have the staff to do that. We don't have the time. I have to admit, I wasn't aware that the state was supposed to be compensating them for a California Public Records Act request. So that's another thing. The publicity about this And now with the funding coming from California, I think local governments will not be able to beg off.
Yeah, very interesting. And there were some comments from various state officials saying, well, I can't – they were suggesting that local jurisdictions wouldn't actually – want to waive this. They'll still comply with the order. And I
oh, no, some of them very much would like to waive yeah. this.
Well, we had Bell and Vernon as very good examples of obfuscation and downright stonewalling and the requests to make those records public. So I think the record there is pretty clear.
Joe, just one thing. I want to put in a plug for the Fresno Bee, and
yeah.
That's in our reporting. We regularly have these watchdog reports on Fresno County government, city government, and for example, Curtis Alexander had a story this week on the fact that all the members of the Board of Supervisors have restored their full pay. Meanwhile, some of their labor groups are still working under pretty heavy pay cuts. And I would have to say that without a healthy media, the people of Fresno County wouldn't have known that fact.
Speaking of compensation and pay and work that you've been doing at the Bee, the issue of Superintendent Michael Hansen's back pay has come up, and a very interesting article in the Bee now about how that came about. What is your take on exactly what Hansen was angling for? He voluntarily, several years ago, decided to forego raises and compensation, and now all of a sudden, over 2 years, he's going to receive an additional $200,000 of money from the district.
So I think you would have to go back and say, okay, what was the tenor of the times there? Was Michael Hansen kind of in a rocky spot? We know that California's finances were very rocky. Fresno Unified's less so, though. I think one criticism you can make of Fresno Unified is that they're so hung up on having a big reserve that they don't put enough money into the classroom. I think you can make that case. But if you go back to that period of time when he did that, I don't think he was that secure with the district. So this was tremendous PR. I'm giving up this $30,000 bonus. I'm not going to take my automatic 3.5% raise. And I think the other thing that it did is it stopped people really taking a hard look at that contract, that the new contract in 2008 that he received, and exactly how lucrative it is. And to think about this, I don't even know if professional athletes receive automatic raises every year, 3.5% in this day and age, and this $30,000 bonus. So he had this tremendous PR of giving this up. And if you go back, we looked in the B files, and, he said it on numerous times. The district said it on numerous times. And as we pointed out in an editorial at the end of 2011, Occupy Fresno was getting a lot of publicity, and they were going to the board meetings, and they were saying, Michael Hansen ought to be making $150,000 a year, not a total package of $385,000. And Susan Bedee comes out, and she's a district spokeswoman, and says, Michael Hansen has given up a total of $120,000 in bonuses. He's given up his raises. He's already doing his part. That's at the very end of 2011, and now we're in the middle of 2013, and we see that Michael Hansen very much wanted that money. And it was interesting in today's article is that the trustees are trying to spin it that, well, this is actually a savings on future obligations that we might have owed him, because his current contract runs through 2016, and it had those clauses in there again, the bonus and the automatic raise. So his new contract doesn't include that. So the district's trying to spin that this is actually saving them money, and it wasn't really about compensating him for bonuses of the past. But I think that's pretty much spin. I mean, clearly he wanted this money. And so you have to think one of two things. If someone's going to say they gave up all this money and then demand it, possibly they're looking at moving on and really don't care about the public image.
We're talking local politics and more with Fresno Bee's Bill McEwen. Speaking of executives in Fresno, Mark Scott, a week ago, the city manager, announced his intention to leave to become the city manager of Burbank. This is a man who 3 years ago had said, this is my final job. He's a Fresno High grad and coming back home to run his native city. And all of a sudden, Measure G fails and the budget mess continues and Mark's leaving.
Well, I guess it's an example that you don't put a lot of stock in pronouncements that are made at news conferences to announce political hirings or government hirings.
There, that and NFL quarterbacks announcing retirements.
So. Exactly the same, because not only did he say this is my last stop, Mayor Swearingen said that Mark Scott is a rock star. And as the editorial I wrote for The Bee said, he didn't do for Fresno what Mick Jagger's done for the Rolling Stones. So basically, Mark Scott helped clean up the finances, identified problems, brought to light the fact that previous administrations hadn't been honest with the public about when they presented a balanced budget. They were taking money from other internal funds that they weren't supposed to. And so, in addition to all the other problems caused by the recession and California's situation, the city of Fresno owed itself $36 million. And so Mark Scott did a good job of bringing that to light. And together with the mayor, they have that balance down to $14 million. That's progress. But if you look at Mark Scott's record on the big things, Fulton Mall's the same as when he came here, no doubt about that. And the 2035 general plan update was passed with much fanfare, but now the development community has dug in opposition to it. In addition, you know, more than a year later, we still haven't heard, what is this plan, you know, that's going to help rebuild these neighborhoods? We have no glimpse at it. And I don't know if we'll have a glimpse at it before Mayor Swearingen leads her second term. So on the big ticket items, I don't think that Mark Scott got the job done, and now the city of Fresno has a different kind of city manager, kind of a Mr. Fix-It. And I think that Bruce Rudd will focus on the things that we call retail politics. I would expect parks are going to look a little better. They'll finally figure out what to do with Fresno's medians. I think the buses will run on time, those kinds of things. And so that means the big policy, the big vision will fall on the shoulders of the mayor exclusively. And previously, Mark Scott shared that with the mayor.
With the defeat of the mayor's Measure G, there's all sorts of talk at City Hall about different political winds blowing, and there's always been an interesting dynamic in a strong mayor former government like we have in Fresno with the council and then the city manager working for the mayor. But the city manager is supposed to run the day-to-day business of the city. Going back to Mark Scott, I thought there was something interesting that he said in his press conference about he wanted to go to a city that has a former government like Fresno used to have, where the council employs the manager and the manager works for the council. Last I checked, the fact that Fresno has a strong mayor former government wasn't a surprise to Mark Scott when he came here 3 years ago. What are your insights into what he might be talking about there? You have the council right now basically doing its own negotiations with FPOA, which, as my understanding of the city charter, the city manager is supposed to be doing labor negotiations. What do you make of Scott's statement there?
I think that's overblown, and I think that's just kind of political chatter. I don't think there's a lot of meat on the bones to that, because when you are a city manager in the council, city manager form of government, you still have to know how to count to four. And so even in that kind of government, politics is a big part of it. Now, maybe it's easier for the city manager to keep four people happy at any one time in that method. But, you know, we call it the strong mayor form of government. But on most matters, if city council can count to five, they can overcome a mayor's veto, and they basically can run the city. So we're seeing a little bit of the council feeling its oats. On the FPOA negotiations, I'm pretty sure that the mayor signed off on this. And just from the idea of FPOA needs to see a new face. Or maybe the mayor was thinking, hey, the city council thinks they can get a winning hand against a strong union. Let them have a try at it.
Speaking of Mayor Swearingen and her political future moving forward, I don't know that she's been touting her name as potential political future beyond Fresno, but others in Sacramento have mentioned her, especially those involved in Republican politics. Measure G's defeat, does it mean anything for her, her record here in Fresno? Where do you see the arrow trending for Swearingen's political ambitions beyond Fresno?
Well, I've never been sure about what her political aspirations are. She's very much a family person, and you know, she comes from what I would call a think tank background. I don't think she's going to run for office right away after her second term is up. I think she'll, you know, take some time out and then assess her situation. Her name's been mentioned as a possible GOP candidate for governor. My reaction to that is that's just her political consultant trying to tout himself. I don't think there were a lot of legs to that. And the other thing is, for the foreseeable future, why would a Republican with a promising career or bigger aspirations run for governor of California? Because you're going to lose.
Yeah, not exactly in recent history a winning proposition.
Well, look at what happened with Meg Whitman. I mean, she spent a lot of money.
Before we go, I want to talk about Senate District 16. We have this special election coming up in a few weeks. Andy Vidak did better than expected. Democrats have a huge voter registration advantage in that race. Do you think Leticia Perez can bring out a good ground game and recoup from what was not exactly a stellar performance in the primary?
Well, I think that the only reason she's in this runoff is because she has a good ground game. I didn't like her campaign at all. I thought it was very gimmicky. You know, just basically it's about minimum wage. Kids must learn English. Now she's trying to redefine herself. And so they're using one of the age-old public relations and political tricks, which is transfer. And in her commercials, she's standing next to Henry T. Perea, who's clearly a lot more popular than her. And she's redefining herself now. You know, I come from a family with a military tradition. I come from a family of entrepreneurs. Henry T. Perea says Leticia is unfairly being labeled an extreme liberal. That's not what she is. In other words, Henry T. Perea is saying she's one of us. She's more in the Valleycrat mode. So this is going to be very interesting. I think that more Democrats will vote this time around, and I think this is going to be a fairly close race. You know, one very interesting thing, though, is Chevron gave large contributions to the Democratic Party and then also to her campaign. And farmers in the South Valley are talking about organizing a boycott of Chevron products. And the danger here is they're not going to hurt Chevron. I mean, there's no way. Chevron's huge. But it's just, you know, associating that boycott is it's kind of a proxy attack on Leticia Perez. So, and they're hoping on the Vidak side that this will be effective.
And, of course, Michael Rubio, Leticia Perez was a staffer for Rubio, and now he resigns, leaving this seat open to take a job with Chevron.
Yes, and what very interesting, early in her campaign, she was touting that Michael Rubio's endorsement. And even on her website, there was a picture of Michael Rubio with her and others. As the campaign went down the road, the Rubio endorsement disappeared. The picture disappeared. I think the Perez campaign found out very quickly that people are not very happy with Michael Rubio.
As you mentioned earlier, the Democrats' two-third majority in the Assembly is about to go away with the election of a resignation of a future L.A. City Council
right.
member to serve in that body. The state Senate's a little bit different animal, but this race is something that people statewide are paying attention to. Do you expect to see a lot of money flowing into the Valley over the next few weeks?
Well, there was a lot of money in the primary, and now there's going to be a ton of money in this runoff. And we're seeing both parties, you know, you're seeing money come from throughout the state, from people that are already in office, giving to the parties, and then the party is, you know, campaigning on behalf or giving the money to the candidates. So huge amount of money in this race because it's extremely important. And the other thing is, Joe, with the change in term limits, whoever wins this has an opportunity to stay in the Senate for a long time. You know about the power of incumbency and actually a good chance to rise to the leadership ranks. So this is a very important election.
It's a very interesting one. We'll keep our eye on it, and we hope to have both candidates on in the coming weeks. Bill McEwen, our guest right now on Valley Edition, talking local politics. Bill McEwen of the Fresno Bee. Bill, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Joe.
We'll be back in just a moment on Valley Edition. Stay tuned. We'll talk about the Woodward Shakespeare Festival, and we'll also talk about big data and your privacy. That's coming up in just a moment on Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. Listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. For the ninth year in a row, the sounds of Shakespeare will fill the warm summer air at Fresno's Woodward Park with the annual Woodward Shakespeare Festival. The group brings the works of the Bard and others to life with three productions this year. The current one, A Midsummer Night's Dream, runs from now through Saturday, July 6th. It's followed by Inherit the Wind, a play by Jerome Lawrence and Robert Edwin Lee, based on the Scopes trial from July 18th through August 10th. And the season comes to a close with a production of Julius Caesar from August 22nd to September 14th. Joining us now on Valley Edition, we have the festival's executive producer, Greg Tabor. Greg, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you very much for having us here. It is our pleasure.
It has to be a very exciting time of year for you because you spend months and months leading up to the season and you're in the middle of your first production of the year right now. How is A Midsummer Night's Dream shaping up so far?
Very exciting indeed. We do spend months and months getting all of this ready and rehearsing, and then we start off, and Midsummer Night's Dream has started off with a bang. We've been averaging 250-plus people at the park. Saturday night we had close to 500 people there, all sitting out there enjoying a wonderful summer evening at Woodward Park, watching a great play.
I know every year you take some Shakespeare classics and put a new twist on them. What is the setting for Midsummer Night's Dream?
Midsummer Night's Dream is fairly straightforward. It's in ancient Athens, the place of order and the old guard and the way it's supposed to be. And then there's the woods outside, the place of the fairies where the young lovers run off to, where things are a little bit more fun, shall we say. So fairly straightforward that way. Not too much of a twist anywhere. Maybe a little bit here and there, but I don't want to give that away.
I want to talk a little more about the actors who take part and make these plays come to life every year. Who are they? Not necessarily their names, but what backgrounds do they come from? Are these professionals? Are they students? Are they community members? Are they out-of-towners? Who makes up the ensemble?
Our ensemble is made up of this community. This year we have an actor who was recently featured at the Irene Ryan Awards in Washington, D.C. We have an actor who has never been on a stage before. We have an actor who has never been on a stage outside of a high school production. We have two actors who have been in every single season we have had. We have one actress who is reprising a role that she originated for us 7 years ago. We take everybody in. We've picked the best cast that we can, and it's our job and our director's job to bring everybody up to speed to provide the best performance that we can provide for our audience.
A few years ago, the organization branched out and started adding some plays that aren't by the Bard.
Yes.
In this case, Inherit the Wind is your one non-Shakespeare production this year and for this season. Tell me a little more about that play and what's coming up July 18th through August 10th for that one.
Inherit the Wind is inspired by the Scopes monkey trial, evolution versus Darwinism. It's not what the play is about, and the authors are very clear about that. Our director, Gabby Lawson, is very clear about that. That is the context of the play. The play is about the freedom to think and the freedom to believe whatever you choose to believe without imposing that belief on someone else. That is very much the tack we are taking. It's a powerful piece. It raises some strong opinions. It has raised some strong opinions in rehearsals already, which is good because that's energy that the actors bring into the show, bring into the characters. So we're very looking forward to what that one might bring to the summer.
And then another all-time classic, Julius Caesar, closes the season.
Yes, the great favorite from sophomore year of high school, Julius Caesar.
Tell us about that production. What can we expect without giving away the whole
thing? Oh, I can't give away too much. Erica Riggs, our director, is going to be taking a little bit of a different tack, somewhat of a modern setting, so we're not going to see togas. General America, late 50s, 60s, again, without getting heavily into Vietnam or any of those specific issues, but that time when things were changing a great deal. And again, kind of a movement from the older power structure to a newer power structure, new voices wanting to be heard in the government, and how that plays out with men of honor and men of ambition and the tension that arises between them and what they think they should do and what they do and how it all turns out.
The Woodward Shakespeare Festival lists its mission as success, growth, and artistry.
Yeah.
That's an interesting combination of words for a theater organization.
Well, we found that that's really what we're about. We are very much about promoting success for our actors. We serve a group of community artists who don't get paid. They do this because they love to do it. We have an obligation to them to promote their success, to make sure that they are successful so that when they go out and do their work, they're doing the best work they can and getting the feedback that they need to continue to do it. We're also committed to fostering their growth, to taking someone who's never set foot on a stage, who's never run a light board, who's never pounded a nail into a set and saying, here's how you do it, and here's how you're going to get better at it. And then it's all about celebrating the artistry because that's what we do. We do this because it's what we do. It's in our blood. It's in our DNA. We act. We produce. We paint. We build because we love to do it. And so we're very much about celebrating that. And we find that when we do those three things, and when we do those three things well, it comes together and we have the best gift that we can give to our audiences. And that's how we look at it. It's a gift. Here it is for you. Enjoy it. Please help us keep doing it.
For people who are thinking about going out to one of the productions this year, it is free.
Absolutely.
You do have a special seating, though, that's also available with a charge.
Yes, so we do.
Give us the particulars.
We work very simply. Every single one of our seats is free. This is our gift to the community. Fresno is the fifth largest city in the state. As our board member, Hal Boland, says, we have to have a Shakespeare Festival, and it has to be free. It is that simple for us. So all of our seats are free. You pay the $5 admission to get into the park. We do have what we call our premium seats, which you may reserve in one of the first two rows for a donation of $10. All that does is guarantee you a seat. If you come down to the park, there are seats available. They are yours.
If people want more information about the season, about the productions, what can they do?
Two places to go, woodwardshakespeare.org, www.woodwardshakespeare.org, or they can call me at 927-3485. I can handle any questions they have.
Be looking forward to it indeed. It's now through Saturday, July 6th, but
correct.
There's one exception there.
There is one exception. We are dark on the 4th in honor of Independence Day.
Fireworks, Shakespeare could be.
Maybe not so much.
Yeah. The Woodward Shakespeare Festival, our guest today, executive producer of the festival, Greg Tabor. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. In this era of big data, with Gmail, Facebook chats, and our family photos all being stored in the big server farms that technology experts call the cloud, what exactly is our expectation of privacy? In this edition of our regular series of commentaries known as The Moral Is, Fresno State Communications Professor Diane Blair says the recent news about government surveillance raises an interesting question about our perceptions of privacy.
The recent revelations of government-sponsored surveillance programs by the National Security Agency and the FBI raises concerns and increased awareness of the erosion of privacy in our modern-day lives. We now live in a world of big data, where our phone calls, emails, and online activities are collected, monitored, and analyzed by government and corporate interests. The right of privacy, enshrined in the Fourth Amendment and often revered as a cornerstone of civil liberties, appears to be in jeopardy. But do we as citizens even care? In a recent Washington Post Pew Research Center survey, a solid majority, 62%, said it was more important for the government to investigate terrorism than it was to protect personal privacy. Why the general lack of concern for this fundamental constitutional guarantee? Maybe it is because we recognize that we've already given up so much of our privacy for the convenience and pleasures of our new digital communication technologies. According to the New York Times, an estimated 2.5 quintillion bytes of new data are created daily. 90% of digital data in the world has been created within the last 2 years, largely due to the proliferation of smartphones and mobile devices. Private corporate interests have been mining our big data for years in order to better market their products and target their persuasive messages. Is it really surprising to find out government agencies have found ways to use this information for their own agendas? Maybe we recognize our own complicity in the loss of privacy. We willingly broadcast our thoughts and values on social media. We gladly hand over personal data to our smartphones that track our movements. We rely on credit cards that record every purchase, and we regularly use internet search engines that show us targeted ads for something we've looked up earlier. We've also come to expect traffic cameras monitoring our driving behaviors and video cameras in public spaces recording our comings and goings. In terms of security, we can see the concrete benefits of this surveillance technology. For example, the Boston Marathon bombing suspects were quickly tracked down because of the presence of security cameras in the area. Perhaps because most cyber surveillance goes unnoticed at the time of data collection, people don't immediately experience their privacy being invaded. Experts in the area of big data argue that we have yet to comprehend the myriad ways in which personal information might be used against us or to target us in particular ways. According to media theorist Douglas Rushkoff, our digital activities have been creating a treasure load of big data that government and corporate strategists have been mining to predict and influence what we buy and for whom we vote. In fact, according to Rushkoff, the true end users of digital media are the marketers, politicians, and government agencies. They are the real customers, and we are the product. Are we willing to move into a digital reality where the assumption of privacy is being exchanged for an assumption of surveillance? Maybe we're already there. For The Moral Is, I'm Diane Blair.
Stay tuned. We'll be back in just a moment with jazz vocalist Karen Margoth to share some of her vocal artistry with us and talk about her new CD that's getting international attention. That's all next on Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. My name is Joe Moore. When people talk about international jazz stars, they don't normally talk about Fresno. But one Fresno musician is quickly gaining a reputation not only in Central California, but nationwide and beyond. She joins us now in the studio. Her name is Karen Margoth. Karen, thanks for stopping by.
Thanks for having me.
Karen is a local vocalist and has released a new CD called Away With Words, The Songs of Carol Coates. And Karen, this is a real California-centric CD in that you have folks from all over the state, including a number of musicians with Fresno ties,
absolutely,
appearing on this album. Mm-hmm. Tell me about how this came about.
Well, I had met Carol Coates. He lives in Carmel on the coast of California. And I was over at his home one day, and he sat down at the piano and started playing some of his tunes. And I didn't realize what a songbook he had until that moment. And I just had the idea of doing an album of his tunes. And then, you know, back home in Fresno, it was a matter of gathering up musicians. And I just wanted, the best that I could get. So you don't have to look much farther than the Central Valley to find some really outstanding musicians. So I just pulled from there's a different group on each song for the most part. We sort of mixed and matched the group according to the tune to sort of make it sound just right, and pulled from Gilbert Castellanos, who is a Fresno native but who lives in San Diego now. Pulled from him. He came up and
he's a great trumpet player.
Oh, fantastic trumpet player. I was just so honored to have him join us on the album. And then Richie Cole, who's from L.A., a great legendary saxophonist. He joined us on several tunes. And a trombonist came down from Sacramento by the name of Bob Williams. I mean, Jason Warner from San Diego came up and played piano and also did the arranging. So, yeah, just a great group.
Tell me some more about Carol Coates. He's a very interesting songwriter. He writes both the music and the words, as mm-hmm. I understand it. And mm-hmm. he's worked with some of the
the biggest names. In fact, he's written songs for some of the biggest names.
Yes, he's a wonderful sort of Randy Britt. He's in his 80s. He's 83. He's fabulous. And he was discovered at the age of 21 by Sinatra. He was living in London and, you know, schlepping his tunes around, trying to shop them around to singers to get them to do his tunes. And Sinatra was there in London to do a concert, and he asked, hey, is there anybody in town who, or is there anybody who has a song about London? He wanted a song about London. And so he heard through the local people there about this guy, Carol Coates, who had a song called London by Night. And he called Carol in, and they became fast friends, and Sinatra did the tune. He recorded it, two or three different versions of it over the years, and that launched Carol's career at the age of 21. Sinatra called him the Kid and brought him over to the States and did a number of his songs, and then that sort of got him going, you know, and he wrote songs for all sorts of sort of famous vocalists of the day, so...
Now, Karen has her band here, and we're going to get to them in just a moment. But this is very exciting to have live music in our studio today, so we're looking forward to this. Tell us a little more about your career, Karen. You're someone who a few years ago sort of burst on the stage beyond Fresno with your last CD that got some amazing write-ups in Jazz Times and Downbeat Magazine, 4.5 stars out of 5, which is usually reserved for stars like Diana Krall and company. In fact, I think you might have actually beat her out in a few of the ratings.
That was an amazing thing. And I call it polite persistence, because I had really no budget for that CD. I recorded it in like a day and a half, again, with local Fresno musicians, great musicians. And then I, you know, ordered 1,000 copies of the CD, because that's the best rate if you order 1,000. So there, then I had like this closet filled with CDs, and, you know, every month or month and a half, I would just package up a bunch of them and send them out to jazz publications and jazz festivals. And I would send them over and over again to the same, you know, places, and just figured if I'm polite and persistent, I'd follow up with emails, you know, phone calls. I was just sort of bold about it, you know. And then the Jazz Magazine in France did a lovely review of it out of the blue. And then just more reviews started coming in. And I think, I feel like the music industry has opened up for the independent artists out there, in the sense that if you are, you know, good, and first of all, you have to be good. And then I think if you are, you know, sort of persistent and polite and human, and you talk to people, you know, on a human level, and you know, ask politely if they might listen to your CD, I think eventually, you know, you'll get heard. And I think that's what happened.
What was it like being a Fresno musician? And I think even in reading some of the reviews of your CD, people were like,
yeah,
this woman is from Fresno? I didn't know that they had musicians in Fresno. But really, the Valley musicians are quite talented. What was that like?
Yeah. You know, it was a real sense of sort of like neener in a way. Sort of like a sense of pride, I guess. You know, like hey, there's almost 1 million people that live in this region. Why wouldn't there be outstanding musicians? And, you know, jazz or good music or good art of any type isn't geographically bound. Like, why would it only come from one place? Why wouldn't it come from here? And so it was sort of like, well, duh, yeah, of course there's great music here.
Now, Karen, you are certainly a professional musician, but that's not your day job.
No.
Tell us a little more about what you do and how this came to be a part of your life briefly before we go to the band.
26 years I've been in public education, and I was a classroom teacher, mostly grades 4 through 8. And now I work with teachers. I'm what's called an instructional support coach, working mostly with new teachers, but also with arts teachers to try to you know, just build teacher capacity and help good people stay in the profession, you know, because it can be a tough profession. So, but fortunately, it's a job that allows me my weekends and my summers to develop my other passion, which is music.
And your Thursday nights.
Yes, I have a Thursday night regular gig, which is lovely.
Great, at the Landmark. Mm-hmm. Karen, tell us about your band. Who did you bring with us today?
Well, I brought my friends Robert Ruffner on trombone this morning, and I've got Rick Canfield on drum.
Singular. Snare with brushes.
Singular, yes. Perfect. And then on piano, Mr. Daryl DeVores.
Well, it's exciting. So I'll go ahead and let you get okay. set up again. We're talking with Karen Margath. Her new CD is called Away with Words. Karen Margath sings the songs of Carol Coates, a legendary songwriter who lives in the Central Coast. And this new CD is out. It's available online on Karen's website. We'll find out more about that in just a moment. And Karen, you have a number for us.
You know I'm crazy, just crazy for you. You know I'm crazy, it's true. If I was someone else's sweetheart, I wouldn't be so blue today. If I was someone else's sweetheart, they wouldn't bring me down this way. They wouldn't keep me dangling like a puppet on a string. I wouldn't have to sit home night after night waiting for the phone to ring. If I was someone else's honey, I wouldn't be in such a mess. You got me in a spin, but still I must confess. Though I might find another who'd be twice as kind and true. If I was someone else's sweetheart, I know I'd still be sweet on you.
Karen Margath in our studio performing live on Valley Edition today. Someone Else's Sweetheart, a tune from her new CD, Away with Words. Karen Margath sings the songs of Carol Coates. We have time for one more tune. Karen, before we do that, if people want to hear you perform live, where can they find you around Central California? Any gigs coming up?
Okay. So I've got a couple coming up at Huntington Lake Resort. If you just Google that, you'll see the dates there, one in July and one in August. Every Thursday night at the Landmark in the lovely Tower District of Fresno.
And in the fall, I'll be at the Arizona Classic Jazz Festival. So
very exciting. And again, your website also?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is?
KarenMargath.com.
All right. Just want to make sure. Great. One more tune. What do you have for us?
Yeah, this is a Latin tune, another recent composition of Carol's. He's in his 80s, but he's still writing. And this is a tune he wrote called I Have a Feeling. And then I wrote it, I did some Spanish lyrics for it. So I'll do it first in the English, and then I'll do it in the Spanish. So,
great. Karen Margath on Valley Edition.
I think you start us off on this one. One, two, one. Feeling deep down inside, we have some feelings that we'd sooner hide, but there's no concealing, things just aren't the same. And I have a feeling we know who's to blame. Where there's true caring, it's wisely been said, there's much more to sharing than just sharing a bed. So I have a feeling it's time to get real. Quit this pretending that it's no big deal, and start revealing again the way that I truly feel. Hay sentimientos dentro de mí. Hay sentimientos escondidos aquí. No puede ocultar y no puedo mentir. Hay sentimientos, no se puede fingir. Se ha dicho sabiamente, amar físicamente es solo una parte del amor verdadero. Hay sentimientos dentro de mí. Y ambos sabemos que esto es amor, el verdadero amor, el que queremos sentir.
Jazz vocalist Karen Margoth and her band joining us today. Her new CD is called Away With Words. We heard Daryl DeVore's piano, Rick Canfield drums, and Robert Ruffner trombone. Karen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
What a pleasure. That's all for this edition of Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us, talk@kvpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, Valley Edition executive producer Ezra Romero, and Valley Public Radio's own Rebecca Plevin, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org.